Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. With the arrest of Rupert Murdoch's protege, Rebecca Brooks, we'll begin with the unfolding scandal that appears to be tearing the news international empire and the Murdoch family apart. Journalist, editor and award-winning author James Fellows joins us. He is the national correspondent of The Atlantic, and we will discuss the apparent payback the political kingmaker is getting in England, where the spell has been broken as politicians no longer fear Murdoch and his minions. Then we will look into the non-appointment of Elizabeth Warren to head up the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau she founded, which opens on Tuesday, with a new person in charge, former Ohio Attorney General Richard Cordray. With the Republicans apparently determined to scuttle a new bureau, we will look into the battle shaping up next week in Congress with Jennifer Taub, professor at the Vermont Law School, whose forthcoming book is titled The Great Betrayal: How Washington Bailed Out Wall Street and Left Main Street Underwater. Then finally, Yasmin El-Rashidi joins us. She has an article in the current edition of the New York Review of Books titled Egypt, the Victorious Islamists. We will discuss the stalled revolution as the ruling Egyptian military council maneuvers with the Muslim Brotherhood to deny the revolutionaries the fruits of their victory in Tahrir Square. I'm now joined by James Fellows, who is the award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. He has written for numerous publications, including The New York Times, The New Yorker, and Slate. He's also the former editor of U.S. News and World Report. His books on media and politics include Who Runs Congress, Breaking the News, How the Media Undermines American Democracy, and Blind into Baghdad, America's War in Iraq. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Fellows.
Ian, very nice to talk to you once again.
And James, you've been writing in The Atlantic about this extraordinary mental gymnastics, shall we say, that the Fox News stalwarts are going through to suggest in some way that Murdoch and News International are the victims of a hacking problem rather than the perpetrators. It would seem that I think this reflects a culture that I think is apparent with Fox and with Murdoch, is that they can dish it out, but they can't take it.
Yes, and the thing which really got my attention was a segment on Fox and Friends, which I'll confess I don't watch regularly, but I saw a YouTube clip where on Friday, when everything was hitting the fan, they had on a so-called hacking expert who was actually a PR man, and they said, yes, hacking is really becoming a big problem worldwide. It's happened to the Pentagon. It happened to Citibank. It's happened to News of the World. And you think, wait a minute. News of the World was the one that was doing the hacking. But I think you're right. There has been an embattled culture in the Murdoch news empire for a very long time, and the question is whether the cumulative effect of the things they're being caught as doing now, whether that's going to have make a lasting difference in how they do business.
Well, with the arrest of Rebecca Brooks, who's apparently a protege of Rupert Murdoch's, and I'm told by my British journalist friends that she's actually somebody that he was who was important to his succession. Do you detect a kind of Shakespearean quality to this, James Fellows, as the family's members maneuver? You know, you've got James, the heir apparent, now looking like he might be facing jail time. You've got Elizabeth from a prior marriage who, from all accounts, is very competent and perhaps waiting in the wings. And now you've got Rebecca Brooks out of the way. And then of course, you've got the more recent Chinese wife, Wendy Deng, who's apparently going her own way, producing movies and, for all intents and purposes, separated from Murdoch.
Indeed, I think that were Shakespeare around, this would be great material. Were Orson Welles still around, this could be a modern Citizen Kane with allowances for difference in technology, differences in politics, and difference in national setting, and the whole generational saga, of course, of Rupert Murdoch coming from a great Australian newspaper dynasty, of establishing himself so prominently with U.S. citizenship and a U.S. base, with his very very significant role in U.K. politics over the past generation plus. You have every aspect of a rich human story coming together here. You have families, you have life cycles, you have different parts of the family layered in, you know, rival offspring, rival wives. You have national differences between the U.S. and U.K., journalistic styles. You have Murdoch's visionary role in various kinds of technology aspects of journalism, perhaps now catching up with him, and you have political intrigue of all sorts. So this is indeed a rich tale, apart from its significance.
And James Fellows, again, a veteran journalist and national correspondent for The Atlantic. The clearly, though, the spell has been broken in terms of the role that Murdoch and News International has played as being the political kingmaker in the United Kingdom, I guess to a lesser extent here. After all, when the Republican field for those wanting to become the next president of the United States was first introduced, I think a goodly number of them are already on Fox News contracts. But it does appear that the spell is broken. And Cameron, of course, the Prime Minister, is quite deeply embroiled because his press aide was is one of the people that's been arrested. I've likened this situation that's been going on in England for a long time now, where Murdoch basically decides who's going to be Prime Minister. Tony Blair had to pay fealty. Gordon Brown had to, and they went ahead and hacked his doctor's records, which is akin to the Nixon going after Ellsberg's psychiatric records. But just in terms of American analogies, doesn't this feel a little bit like J. Edgar Hoover, the way he blackmailed congressmen and senators?
Very much so. And I think it's interesting that in both countries, the UK and the US, Murdoch and his publications have been very influential, but in different ways. As you say, in the UK, since Murdoch bought a variety of publications a generation plus ago, he's been at the center of politics across party. And with the apparent connection of his publications and the police, you did have this J. Edgar Hoover type overhang. In the U.S., it's been different in that the Murdoch publications, led by Fox News, but also the Weekly Standard and the Wall Street Journal's editorial page, although it had this role even before Murdoch, they've had the combined roles of being very, very influential on the right, where the Republican Party has had Fox News as its most influential propaganda organ, I would say. And he's been influential across party, mainly as the opposition voice. Both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama were very, very heavily influenced by the attacks and the characterizations that Fox News was able to launch. So in both countries, he's had a big role. I think the UK role has certainly changed. The question will be whether a year from now, 5 years from now, we see that his role as the main face of conservatism has changed or not.
And in terms of the good, the bad, and the ugly of this story, the ugly, of course, is Millie Dowler, the 13-year-old who was murdered, and for 6 months they couldn't find her body. Meanwhile, News Corp journalists and operatives, I guess, whose checks are being signed by James Murdoch, they were out deleting phone messages in her, which of course pained the parents enormously. And not only were they destroying evidence, but they gave the parents the illusion that the child was alive. This has really shocked the conscience of the nation. Plus, it's forced Murdoch to do a mea culpa, and apparently he was very contrite, shall we say. That's the ugly. Do you want to add anything to that? Because I wanted to get onto the good.
Well, the ugly, I think it took that episode and also the apparent hacking into the phone accounts of victims of terrorism in England to really make this not just a political dispute, but something that was deeply repellent to everybody at a human level. And I think that's why even David Cameron played the role that was saying that Rebecca Brooks had to leave, et cetera. So, yes, I agree that's the ugly.
Well, in terms of the good, though, I think that there's no question that The Guardian, which is an interesting model, which perhaps we can talk about in terms of the press, it's a trust. The Guardian newspaper, the reporter Nick Davies and their investigative reporter were really doggedly stuck at this story. Nobody else on Fleet Street supported him. He had tremendous resistance and described by the editor of The Guardian as a fusillade of lies from News International. No cooperation, indeed hostility from his fellow journalists. He stuck with the story and eventually he's been vindicated. And he's now being compared to the British equivalent of Woodward and Bernstein.
Yes, and I think that all credit needs to go to the Guardian and its care and persistence on this. And It's interesting that over the past year plus, there have been two disparate episodes which have, I think, reemphasized the importance of traditional journalism, and The Guardian has been involved in both of them. One is the whole WikiLeaks case in which the New York Times, The Guardian, Spiegel, and I think, I don't know if there's another organization, essentially were charged with vetting what information Assange was putting out and seeing which things are fit to publish or not. And now this case, where without the professional resources that The Guardian was able to bring to bear, it's likely the story might have might never have come to light.
Well, apparently the story was in trouble, and the Guardian weren't getting any support from the British press. Nobody else was picking up on it. But what gave the story legs and infused it with some juice, if you will, was the New York Times. They sent three journalists over. Obviously they also cooperated on the WikiLeaks, along with the El País was the fourth.
Yes, thank you for that. I had forgotten which was the other organ that was involved. And I think you can certainly confirm with me for most American listeners. I think many Americans have the idea of the British press as being an all very high-toned operation. And in fact, at its high levels, it can be high-toned. At its low levels, it can be quite a bit more raucous and crude than what is normally respectable within the U.S. context. That's why so many American tabloid editors have come or been trained in the U.K. or on Fleet Street. So you can see why the News of the World got away with this for a while, but then this decade's worth of pushing the envelope has finally caught up with them.
Well, perhaps it will come across here in the sense that Piers Morgan's one of their protégés.
Yes, I will be. You know, it has been fascinating to see how Fox News has not covered this story at all. The Wall Street Journal, one of the jewels in our journalistic establishment, I think has not distinguished itself by the coverage of the story. We'll see how they do over the next week or two. We'll also see how Piers Morgan does in the days ahead on CNN.
Well, apparently the FBI are looking into the possibility that News International reporters here in the United States hacked into victims of 9/11, which again is so unseemly that it's likely to generate the similar outrage here in the United States.
Yes, I think that's the one topic on which the normal partisan divide might be surmounted, and people wouldn't otherwise, in other circumstances, be loyal to Fox News and think that any critics of Fox News must be somehow ignoble in their motivations. This could have the same repellent factor that the Dowling case did in England. So this is the other point I'd make is that I was just out of college and a reporter in D.C. when the Watergate scandal was breaking. What is similar so far is the fact that every day there's something new, and so far something you would have been astonished by a week beforehand. To have the News of the World closed, to have the B Sky B deal withdrawn, to have Brooks apparently being arrested, to have Les Hinton resign, none of these would have been believable at all even a month ago. And that is, I think, also it suggests poor management of the story, at the least, by the Murdoch interest in just sort of letting these things drip out day by day by day.
Well, it's a reminiscent of the old Watergate adage that the cover-up's worse than the crime.
Yes, and in this case, the crime was plenty bad enough.
Well, exactly. Well, I must say, though, James, fellas, I'm a tiny bit amused by the New York Times' schadenfreude, shall we say, in covering this story. There's clearly no love lost between the New York Times and Murdoch.
Yes, but can you blame them? Right. Can you blame them? This is their opponent over the decades that has always sort of poo-pooed them for having these preacherly high standards and for all their own failings, now being caught in the most egregious way, and every suspicion that you've had has been confirmed. So I think I understand on a human level where the Times is coming from. I might even have such feelings myself. Who could say?
Well, let's maintain our veneer of objectivity here. What about, though, just in closing then, the lessons for the media in general? I mean, one lesson clear seems to me to be, which is, I think, an interesting one, is not just the role of The Guardian, but the way it's set up as a trust.
Yes.
which it makes it immune from a lot of the whims of newspaper magnates using their publishing organs as a private soapbox, you know. And I mean, it used to be restrained by the fairness doctrine, you know.
Yes.
Where titans couldn't, if they wanted to proselytize their own points of view and promote their agendas, they had to offer equal time to an opposing point of view. That's gone, thanks to President Reagan. So, where do we stand in that regard?
I think this has been a useful reminder that of the three main ways ownership can be structured in for news organizations, which is the strict corporate model, the individual tycoon model, and the nonprofit model, each of them has their strengths and weaknesses. We've been very much exposed in the last 10 years to the weaknesses of the corporate model. For example, the problems of the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune, as Sam Zell has come in. We have seen people have often clung to the benefits of the tycoon model, saying the Sulzbergers and the Grahams for a while kept their publications on the high road, as the Chandlers had done in Los Angeles years ago. And then there is the nonprofit model, which The Guardian exemplifies, which in a way NPR has its role. You know, it's the state supported and public supported. So I think in the long run, none of these models is perfect. But a balance, they each have certain assets, and The Guardian's performance here has been a sign of the kind of strength that model can give. So I think we're going to see a mixture of these three models going forward.
By the way, though, I think you have to add the BBC to this, because the BBC in London is absolutely, Murdoch's obsessed with it. It's his number one enemy. He'd like to bring it down. And the reason I think they have more diversity in the press in England is because of the BBC, that you couldn't get, you know, that Fox can get away with the extreme speech here, but not in the way that, because there's always the BBC to pull them over and do a fact check.
Yes, and I think that is a very important, I'll use the term advisedly, legacy asset that both, that in different ways the UK, Canada, and Australia have, of having strong, independent, state-supported news organizations. In the U.S., that is the case with NPR. Public TV is in a much more embattled situation. So it is a sign of how important that is. So, yes, I would include that in the mix very much so.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, James Fellows.
It's a pleasure to speak with you again. Bye.
Bye. Again, I've been speaking with James Fellows, who's an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. He has written for numerous publications, including The New York Times, The New Yorker, and Slate. He's also the former editor of U.S. News and World Report. His books on media and politics include Who Runs Congress? Breaking the News, How the Media Undermines American Democracy, and Blind into Baghdad, America's War in Iraq. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how come Elizabeth Warren didn't get the job that she created.